This is a quick run through of my Civil Procedure 2 outline. It starts off with basic pleading. A pleading is a piece of paper containing factual allegations. The rule to keep in mind is Rule 7, which indicates the types of pleadings allowed. The types of pleadings allowed are complaints, an answer to a complaint, which is an answer to a counterclaim or a cross-claim, a third-party complaint, or an answer to a third-party complaint, and in some jurisdictions, a reply to an answer. Another rule to keep in mind is Federal Rule 8, which is the general rules of pleadings. The first general rule is a short and plain statement of the grounds of the court's jurisdictions. The second rule is a short and plain statement of the claim showing that the pleader is entitled to relief, also known as notice pleading. And number three is a demand for relief sought, which may include relief and the alternative of different types of relief. We then move on to notice pleading, which starts off with the case of DiGuardi. In this case, DiGuardi filed a complaint alleging facts not including a detailed description of his legal claims. He claimed that the defendant illegally sold his imported goods. Here the court concluded that the plaintiff need to just show entitlement to relief. A short and plain statement was okay. The court further asserted that the plaintiff cannot assert anything he or she wishes. Federal Rule 11 requires a pleader to have evidentiary support for factual contentions. We then move on to heightened pleading, or pleading with particularity. In analyzing heightened pleading, we look to Rule 9B, which states that a more detailed pleading is required for allegations of fraud and mistake or special damages. The case in this section was Leatherman v. Tarrant, in which police conducted conduct violated the Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. The issue was whether the federal court could apply a heightened pleading standard in civil rights cases, and the court concluded if it's not in the rules, you can't apply a heightened pleading. The court also asserted that because of the special damages, they must be pled with particularity. We then move on to the plausible pleading standards. It starts off with the Calmley standard, which was a complaint should not be dismissed for failure to state a claim unless it appears beyond a doubt that the plaintiff can prove no set of facts in support of this claim which would entitle him to relief. We then move on to the Twombly standard, in which a plaintiff must nudge their claim across the line from possible to plausible. This is a two-part test. In this test, you take the factual allegations in the complaint as true, and then determine whether the allegations plausibly give rise to an entitlement of relief. The next standard was the Ashcroft v. Iqbal, in which Iqbal needed to provide facts plausibly showing Ashcroft purposely adopted the policy because of race, religion, or national origin. The issue was if the allegations make the conduct plausible as opposed to conceivable. If they're not plausible, the complaint fails to state a claim. This, again, is using the Twombly standard of nudging a claim from across the line from possible to plausible. We must also keep in mind Rule 7B, which is motions and other papers. In general, a request for a court order must be made in a motion. The motion must be A, in writing unless made during a hearing or trial, and B, state with particularity the grounds for seeking the order. Rule 10 are form pleadings. Part A is the captions, names of the party. Part B, paragraphs and separate statements. Part C, adoption of reference. We then move on to responding to the complaint. Common responses to a complaint are default judgments, Rule 12B motions, which is subject matter jurisdiction, personal jurisdiction, venue notice, failure to state a claim. Another type of response to a complaint is an answer. The types of responses to the allegations: admit, deny, or lack of sufficient info. There's also affirmative defenses or claims by the defendant. All right, we start off with a default option, which was shown in the case of Virgin Records America v. Lacey. Here, the plaintiff's motion for default judgment after the defendant was served and failed to respond to the complaint did not appear in the action. Rule 55 allows default judgment to be removed for a good cause if the judge feels the defendant did not get service. In this case, the defendant did get service. And then there's Rule 60B, which is relief from a judgment or order because of corrections. We then go on to moving to dismiss, which is under Rule 12. The Rule 12 motions, starts off with B. A party may assert the following defenses. 12B6, failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted, and Rule 12B5, insufficient service of process. Rule 12B6 is a test for the sufficiency of the pleading to commence a lawsuit. It is not a test on the merits of the claim. The allegations must be accepted as true. Rule 12F is a motion to strike any redundant, immaterial, impertinent, or scandalous matter. Rule 12E is a move for a more definite statement of a pleading to which a responsive pleading is allowed, but which is so vague or ambiguous that the party cannot reasonably prepare a response. The case in this was Matos v. Nextrand, in which the court asserted that a complaint needs not to be a literary gem. If it gives greater clarity when separated by issue, we use Rule 8, but again, it does not need to be a literary gem, which is under Matos v. Nextrand. The Rule 12 waiver trap commands joinder of available defenses and objections in one pre-answer motion and imposes waiver as a penalty for leaving certain defenses out. In the case of Hunter v. ServTech, Offshore filed a motion to dismiss under Rule 12b-5. Hunter then filed an amended complaint, which Offshore answered, raising lack of personal jurisdiction, and which the court concluded that Offshore waived personal jurisdiction pursuant to Rules 12g-2 and 12h-1 because it filed its pre-answer motion to dismiss without including personal jurisdiction defense in the motion. Now, when you file a pre-answer motion under Rule 12G, the omnibus motion rule, forbids from making another motion based on the defense or objection that was available to it when it filed the pre-answer motion. So if you have a defense or motion available to you, when you answer a pre-answer motion, if you don't use it, you waive it. Rule 12H1, omitting any of the 12B2 through 5 defenses from pre-answer motion, waives that defense, basically what I just said. We then move on to the answer. Starts off with, you can answer with a denial, in which you reject the allegations, or you can answer with affirmative defenses, which admits the allegation but asserts a legal excuse from liability. A case in this section was Reese Robotics USA, in which Reese's claims are barred or limited by latches, waivers, estoppel, unclean hands, or similar legal or equitable doctrine under Rule 8B1A, along with 8C. The buzzword in this case was bare bones conclusory statements are not permissible. Rule 8B5 states that a party that lacks knowledge or information sufficient to form a belief about the truth of the allegation must so state. Comparable to Rule 11B, an attorney or unrepresented party certifies that to the best of that person's knowledge, information, and belief, formed after an inquiry reasonable under the circumstances, denials of factual allegations are warranted on the evidence or is specifically so identified are reasonably based on the belief of lack of information. Now, a response that the defendant lacks information is a denial, and that was in the case of Ingram, where a defendant may usually amend an answer to include a new defense, even at trial, provided that the plaintiff has sufficient notice and is not prejudiced through the unfair surprise. In Ingram,